Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, May 25th. Hope you're doing well. Big show today. Bottom of this hour, we're going to be talking to Timothy Stanley. Timothy, who is a British historian and journalist, writes in the London Daily Telegraph, Catholic Herald, sometimes featured in CNN, often on things related to politics. But we're going to go a different route today. Of course, Timothy, who has told the story on this program before of his own conversion to the Catholic faith after being an atheist Marxist, or would that be a Marxist atheist? I'm not sure, during his youth. I want to get his take on a troubling story that came out of Great Britain, that people of no religion now outnumber Christians in England and in Wales. Now, this study is pretty stunning in its results. Maybe it's an outlier of some sort. I don't know. But according to this from The Guardian, people of no religion outnumber Christians in England and Wales. And that is because from 2011 until 2014, so a three-year period, those who identify as having no religion in Great Britain rose from 25% to 48.5%, so almost doubling in 3 years. Those who define themselves as Christians, meanwhile, as I said, those who identify as no religion, 48.5%. Those who define themselves as Christian, Anglicans, Catholics, and other denominations, made up 43.8% of the population. Now, that is a staggering sociological and demographic shift. And I want to get Timothy Stanley's take on that. I know I've seen that he has tweeted in response to this article. And particularly his issue is that Catholics and other Christians, really, the proper response to these kind of stats is not whining, but to do what we are responsible for doing. So we'll talk to Timothy Stanley about that at the bottom of the hour. And then in the second hour, we're going to have Eve Tushnet back. We had Eve on a couple of weeks ago. Eve, the author of the book, Gay and Catholic, Accepting My Sexuality, Finding Community, Living My Faith, as well as a novel called Amends, who lives in Washington, D.C. and blogs at Patheos. Eve, who was really an atheist, nominally Jewish, had that background. She came out while she was in high school as a lesbian, ended up being drawn not only to the Christian faith, but to the Catholic Church while she was in college. And even though she has come to terms with her own sexuality and continues to self-identify as a lesbian, she also accepts Catholic teaching on the proper ordering of human sexual behavior. And so she has chosen to live a life not expressing her lesbian desires in homosexual intimacy, or sexual intimacy, let's just say. She's really focused in on recovering and strengthening the biblical concept of spiritual friendship. And we had her on a couple weeks ago. I thought it was a fascinating conversation. And we ran out of time before I could talk to her about another big issue that I wanted to talk to her about. And that is, how do you as a parent, if you are a Catholic parent, or if you are a Protestant Christian parent who believes the classical Christian understanding of human sexuality, and that homosexual sexual intimacy is intrinsically and objectively immoral, how as a parent do you deal with it when your child comes to you and says, I think I may be gay? Whether that's that child is a young adolescent who's really struggling with confusion, whether they're older and more determined and settled in who they are, how do you deal with that as a parent? How do you simultaneously uphold the teaching and the moral vision of the church while at the same time supporting and loving your child? It is an interesting and challenging situation to be in. Not that you don't, of course, you always love your child. There's a degree of to which that's innate to parenthood, though even that love has to be redeemed, as all human loves have to. But the way it's oftentimes pitched in our world, that those two ideas are incompatible. That if you love your child, you have to support their identity and their decisions in terms of their choices. And how do you navigate that? And how do you, particularly in the mind and the heart of an adolescent, where there's so much confusion anyway, how do you avoid shaming them while at the same time avoid sort of almost the cultural dogma in which we live in now, that you need to push them to embrace their identity before they even really fully know who they are? So I think Eve Tushnet has a great perspective from her background, and I'll be interested in her take on that. And I also want to ask her how can parishes do the same thing as parents? How can we love and stand with people while at the same time who self-identify as gay and lesbian, while at the same time affirming the Catholic moral vision? Because what you oftentimes see happen, and this is true with parents, they have a certain belief, and then their child comes out as gay, and then all of a sudden, because it's sort of set up, pitted to them as a choice between their faith and their child, and for some people, hey, it's an easy choice. You choose the child, and so they abandon their belief because it's now my child who's dealing with this. We sometimes find the same thing happening with people. They may not be a parent, maybe someone they know. How to navigate this is really tough, and I'm looking forward to what Eve has to say about it. You're certainly welcome to call with questions or comments anytime during the program today, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Looking at the reading today, the first, we're continuing still in this first chapter of the first letter of St. Peter. It's really beautiful exposition St. Peter has on understanding our own identity and who we are as a Christian disciple. Beloved, St. Peter writes, realize that you were ransomed from your futile conduct, handed on by your ancestors, not with perishable things like silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a spotless, unblemished lamb. He was known before the foundation of the world, but revealed in the final time for you, who through him believe in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Then you skip down to the gospel reading for the day. And the gospel reading has Jesus on his way up to Jerusalem, and those behind him amazed and afraid. I guess as it says, maybe it's in Luke's gospel, that he had his face set like flint, his determination, the sense of foreboding, perhaps those amazed and afraid behind him. He predicts his upcoming suffering. And then you have this whole account, James and John, who have to be as spiritually discerning and sensitive as a fence post in this context. Jesus on his way up to suffer, and they're arguing and bickering, having been two of the three in Jesus' inner circle, privileged to view the transfiguration. Now they're contending for the prime positions at the Lord's right and left hand at the time of the coming into his kingdom. And Jesus begins to say, you do not know what you're asking. Can you drink the chalice that I drink or be baptized with the baptism with which I'm baptized? And then he goes on, our Lord does, to say that you know that those who are recognized as rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones make their authority over them felt, but it shall not be so among you. Rather, whoever wishes to be great among you will be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you will be the slave of all. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So what's the connect? You know, sometimes you want to see you get this passage from 1 Peter, and then you've got Mark chapter 10, and we'll get into this a little bit in the second hour as well. But in Mark chapter 10, you have Jesus explaining, in the midst of his disciples' misguided thirst for power and influence, Jesus, whose mind is on the passion to come, makes clear to them what his mission is. His mission was not to come and to claim power for himself, power he willingly laid aside in taking on human flesh. He came to give his life as a ransom, to buy back those who were now under the possession, under the jurisdiction of the devil and death. And it's that ransom, of course, to which St. Peter refers in the first reading. So that's the connect point, so to speak. Jesus said he came to give his life as a ransom for many. Peter, in this first chapter of his first letter, reminds those recipients of his letter that they were ransomed. And what were they ransomed with? They were ransomed not with perishable things like silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a spotless, unblemished lamb. Next hour, we're going to get back into these two passages, and I want to think for just a minute about the counterintuitive path to humility and how it really is something that unfolds in these two passages. We so misunderstand humility and how we get there. And this passage gives us an understanding of that, particularly this First Peter passage. We got to know who we are to be able to find peace in that. We'll be back with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you are back on the Mike Allen Show. Bottom of the hour here in about 15 minutes, we'll be talking to Timothy Stanley. Timothy, who is from across the pond, a British journalist and historian. We'll talk about some of the alarming statistical numbers coming out of the UK on the issue of the decline of faith, the rise of those who identify as no religion at all, and what is a Catholic to do in that circumstance? He's got an answer, and by the way, whining, from his point of view, not an option. If we've got time, I'll get his take on the political things unfolding in this country, too. He writes on that kind of stuff for CNN as well. Great person to follow on Twitter as well, Timothy Stanley. Anyway, in the next hour, we're going to be talking to Eve Tushnet, as I said. Eve, who wrote her book, Gay and Catholic, Accepting My Sexuality, Finding Community, Living My Faith. And I want to talk to her particularly about the proper way that parents can best support a child who is wrestling with their sexuality, who may be an older child, a late teen or early adult, who has come out and identified as gay, or maybe how to help a child who's in the early stages of struggling with that. And how can we best support our child, love our child, while also affirming the Catholic moral vision. And we'll also talk about that at a parish level, how we can best support and accompany while also holding true to what we believe. So that'll be a good conversation. And so I'm asking a question of the day very much related to that. Not nearly as easy a decision, or a question to ask as, what is your worst hairstyle decision you've ever made? A little bit deeper today. How can a parent best support a child identifying as gay while also affirming the Catholic moral vision? Got a few comments on this on Facebook. And by the way, you can call or text me, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. Susan writes, I will be there unconditionally. I will not be that judging Christian who fails every day telling my child or my friend how to live their life. It is between them and God. No amount of me preaching is going to sway them. I will love. Then she quotes 1 John 4:7-8. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. And then she quotes from John chapter 8, a woman caught in adultery, in which Jesus said, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. Susan, I get what you're saying. I don't think in any other context we would say that love means an automatic endorsement of every decision. We can love our child who is also who doesn't go to church, let's say. We love them without condition. However, that doesn't mean that we're not concerned about the state of their soul and their faith and everything else. We could love a child who is caught in the trap of addiction, right? It doesn't mean that we endorse addictive patterns. Anyway, Laura says, that's a hard one. Support and love, I suppose. They know the church's teachings, what's wrong, what's right. I wouldn't condone the lifestyle, but would not condemn the child. Difficult to say the least, yes. And Cindy says, no one knows until they walk in those shoes. And says, and then I might add, who knows if they are really handling it correctly. Give a couple more comments maybe in the next hour. But if you've got a thought that you want to chime in on that, 573-4BREAD-4, or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. A big win for the Oklahoma City Thunder last night. And now they're up 3-1 after the Draymond Green debacle in Game 3 and the decision that to not suspend Draymond Green, to which Keith here, who's, you want to talk to Keith, who's screening calls, he'll be happy to talk to you about it and his theory that the NBA is rigged. Well, if they've wanted to rig Golden State in the finals, Oklahoma City did not get the memo. Because Oklahoma City is playing some serious big boy basketball right now. And they're up 3-1 over Golden State. And, you know, you almost get the sense. I didn't really see the game last night. I saw some of the highlights. But you got to wonder, is Golden State almost a little bit just kind of tired? You know, did they invest so much in their 73 wins? I don't know. Or maybe it's just that the Thunder have figured them out. They've learned how to defend them well. It has been an impressive, I would say, one of the more impressive NBA runs so far. If the Oklahoma City Thunder can go back to Golden State and finish off a 73-9 Golden State team, 4-1 in the Western Conference Finals. I mean, that is impressive. And I got to tip my hat to Billy Donovan, because I'll be honest with you. And Billy Donovan, Eddie Munster, as I call him, he of the widow's peak, by all accounts a great guy and a faithful practicing Catholic. I was bitter when he was at Florida because he beat my Kentucky Wildcats a few times. But I'm not afraid to admit my immaturity. But I always thought that maybe Billy, though he won two straight national titles at Florida, maybe he just caught lightning in a bottle with a special group of recruits. If he goes out and wins an NBA title, it's going to be pretty tough to dispute Billy Donovan's credentials as a coach. No question about it. So we'll see. Can Golden State rally? This is the first time they've lost two straight, I think, all season. So we'll see how they respond. And then, of course, you got Raptors-Cavaliers, I believe, coming up tonight in a big Game 5. If they can, Raptors can go into Cleveland and win. All of a sudden, who knows? What everybody thought was going to be LeBron, Steph may end up being Raptors Thunder. We'll have to see how it plays out. Again, 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to give us a call, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. We've got some What Were You Thinking nominees for the day. We'll get into these. Spanning the globe as per usual to find examples of human beings not thinking well. We're going to start with this guy. A guy in Wisconsin who is on his 10th drunk driving conviction now. A Wisconsin man who blamed the smell of alcohol on his breath on beer-battered fish has been sentenced to prison on his 10th drunken driving conviction. Really? Evidently, the Adams County Sheriff's Department stopped Prisbilla because his vehicle had a broken tail lamp. The deputy smelled alcohol on his breath. When asked about his alcohol intake, he reportedly said the smell was due to the beer-battered fish he had recently eaten. Why does this story make me hungry? I love beer-battered fish. just don't try to blame your .062 blood alcohol level on your beer battered fish. Got to be a better excuse than that. All right, so that's our first one. Our second two, our nominee and then our winner, we're going to be on both sides of the climate change aisle. We'll start first with the climate change deniers, Donald Trump being one of them. Except it turns out that the billionaire who called global warming a hoax has warned of its dire effects in his company's application to build a seawall to protect his golf course. Donald Trump says he is not a big believer in global warming. He has called it a total hoax and pseudoscience, but he's also trying to build a seawall designed to protect one of his golf courses from global warming and its effects. The New York billionaire is applying for permission to erect a coastal protection works to prevent erosion at his seaside resort, Trump International Golf Links and Hotel, Ireland in County Clare. A permit application for the wall explicitly cites global warming and its consequences. Increased erosion due to rising sea levels and extreme weather this century. Oh my goodness. Donald Trump is working to ensure his at-risk properties. This from South Carolina Republican Representative Bob Inglis. He's working to ensure his high-risk properties, and his company's trying to figure out how to deal with the sea level rise. Meanwhile, he's saying things to audiences he must know are not true. You have a soft place in your heart for people who are honestly ignorant, but people who are deceitful, that's a different thing. Yeah. You don't, at the same time, talk out of both sides of your mouth, Donald. As I've said, I have no problem with the science of climate change. I really don't. Yes, I have concerns about the way that some environmentalist extremists denigrate the human person, see human beings as a parasitic presence on the planet. All that stuff is, you got to be vigilant against. But it's hard for me to believe that this massive hoax going on. And the way I see it, being a good steward of the earth is a win-win proposition, no matter what the circumstances are. Anyway, but we're going to go to the other side of the aisle for our What Were You Thinking winner, and that's going to be Mr. Leonardo DiCaprio, who picked up an environmental award in New York City this week. And to do that, he took his private jet from France 8,000 miles to the Big Apple and then flew straight back to France on another jet for a model-packed fundraiser a night later. In other words, he, let's say, greatly expanded his carbon footprint. Environmental analyst Robert Rapier, who said the actor's movie star lifestyle diminishes his moral authority to lecture others, he said he demonstrates exactly why our consumption of fossil fuels continues to grow. It's because everyone loves the combination of cost and convenience they offer. So, Leo, how about a little consistency, brother? You get our What Were You Thinking award for the day. When we get back, we're going to talk to a real thinker, and that is Mr. Timothy Stanley from across the pond about the decline of faith in the UK. This is The Mike Allen Show. Welcome back to the Mike Allen Show here at the bottom of the hour. Privileged to have Timothy Stanley with us via Skype. He's an English blogger, journalist, and historian. Timothy, who writes for the Telegraph and also for CNN, has his own blog. Excellent stuff. And we're going to talk to him about the decline of faith in the in Great Britain. Hello, Timothy.
Good morning.
I immediately thought of you when I saw this story from The Guardian. Very staggering numbers in Great Britain. I think between 2011 and 2014, the number of those who identify as having no religion rose from 25% to 48.5%. And I was, of course, drawn to that story through one of your tweets about it. Is that an outlying survey, or do you think that's really as stark as the picture is?
I'm a little bit suspicious about it. figure so dramatically different from 2011. It's hard.
Mr. Stanley, you still there? You're breaking up on us a little bit. Mr. Stanley? All right, I tell you what, Ethan, let's try to dial him up again. We'll see if we can get it worked out. Yeah, 48.5% in 2014 who identified as nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S. And in 2011, it was 25%. I mean, those kind of demographic shifts don't happen. So I can understand Mr. Stanley's skepticism in those figures. The other figure that... Oh, hello.
I'm back again. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what happened there. A line dropped for some reason. Sorry, I'm here.
No problem at all. We were talking about the...
As I was just saying, the one explanation behind this change in British identity when it comes to religion is that people who are born Christian or raised Christian but don't actually attend church have stopped describing themselves as Christian. So I think it's jumping to conclusions to say that this represents the terminal decline of Christianity in Britain. What it represents is the evaporation of an old cultural Christianity. You can no longer assume that people in Britain identify as Christian.
So in other words, this is, in a sense, this is a manifestation of something that's been brewing and unfolding for some time.
Oh, absolutely. It's been happening since the 1960s, and really this is just the final stage of it. I mean, in my country, a majority of people no longer get married in church. You know, a vast majority of people do not get christened or baptized. So you're seeing that shift. Significant proportions do not have their funerals have any religious content in their funerals. The humanist funeral is now increasingly the standard for funerals. So in terms of everyday experience of life in Britain, these survey results reflect that, and that's what's changed, is that people aren't saying that the people no longer naturally associate being British with being Christian. They don't see those two things as synonymous.
Yeah, one other staggering figure. You were on, I think, this past August, and you told some about your own journey from being a self-described atheist and Marxist to becoming a Catholic. So, but for every person like you who not raised Catholic, who becomes Catholic, according to this survey, 10 former Catholics leave the practice of the faith. And for Anglicans, it's even worse. It's 12.
Yes.
12 slip away for everyone who enters.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, it doesn't help that both churches don't encourage conversion, so it's not entirely surprising. but yes, that figure of one coming in and 10 going out is very, very troubling. It's been disguised in Britain for a long time by mass immigration. So in Britain today, given that we have an established Anglican church, you would imagine that would be the largest church. But no, in terms of church attendance, the largest church is now the Catholics. But that's not because British Catholics are particularly faithful. It's because we've taken a vast number of people from Poland. So the demographic change has been this change on the Catholic side has been slightly disguised. And it's very striking that in many parishes in England now, you have two services. You have an English one in the morning and a Polish one at about midday. And my local church down in Brighton, they sometimes lock the door in between the services. And you see the queue for the Polish Mass, and it stretches around the church. So you'll have 15, 20 people coming for your average English Mass. You see the Polish one, and it's standing room only. So this is a particular British phenomenon of declining church attendance and declining identification with Christianity.
We're talking with Timothy Stanley, English blogger, journalist, and historian. You know, one of the things that you commented on, and I love following your tweets, and I encourage other people to follow Timothy Stanley on his Twitter account. But you said that hand-wringing and whining, so to speak, really are not the proper responses to studies like this for the British Christian.
Absolutely, yes. A couple of years ago, one of our cardinals, Cormac Murphy O'Connor, was quoted as saying that Christianity was facing death in England. I find such remarks so fatalistic and unhelpful. It's untrue. And this is the problem, is that I think a lot of people in the hierarchy of most Christian churches regard their jobs as being one of almost curating of being there at the end, of keeping things going. And it's that attitude which has led to this sharp decline, because the churches simply aren't promoting, they're not proselytizing. The comparison I draw is, to take an American version of it, say Walmart stopped advertising. Well, people would stop going to Walmart. And if Walmart said that the quality of its products was no different to Target, people would stop going to Walmart. And if Walmart kept on saying, I've got to admit, our product isn't very good, people would stop going to Walmart. But these are all the things that Christian churches in Britain have been doing. They haven't been promoting themselves. They've been talking themselves down, and they've been compromising constantly. And so they don't make the case for themselves. And I would say that we've reached a point, this survey is a wake-up call, where you've really got to re-evangelize in Britain. That's the only way to reverse that decline.
This is something really, I know that then Cardinal Ratzinger and, of course, Pope Emeritus Benedict talked often about this and this move toward a post-Christian Europe and a church that it gets perhaps, in a way, stripped of a lot of its structural security, I guess you could say, and perhaps, you know, its institutions and all the things that have allowed it to perhaps mask the sort of rot that was going on from the inside. These sorts of things, I guess, force us to wake up and to see what's happening and to decide. You know, I'm reminded of that haunting verse from the Gospels in which Jesus says, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?
Yes, I think that's so true. And I think in Europe, you've seen in many countries an unhealthy relationship between church and state, where one props the other up. An example of this, I'd encourage listeners to Google it because it's a remarkable story, is a recent scandal involving the Norwegian church. In Norway, the church can get a certain amount of government money depending upon how many members it has. And what the church was doing was whenever there was an immigrant with a Polish-sounding name or an Italian-sounding name or a Spanish-sounding name moving into their parish, they automatically registered them as being a member of the local church, even if they weren't a Catholic or they weren't going to church. And so by doing this, the church was able to claim lots of money that it really wasn't due. And this scandal was unearthed when people who were members of secular associations and atheist associations discovered that they were registered as being members of their local church. Now, this is, the church argues in its defense that what's behind this is unintentioned bad bookkeeping. Fair enough, that may well be the case. But the point is that when you develop that kind of relationship with the state, where you're dependent upon it, when you're dependent upon the establishment for its generosity, you can lose some of that will to evangelize and some of that will to be a radical voice that challenges the establishment. And that's what I fear has happened in so many countries. And that's really the story that's the story behind the decline of the Anglican Church in Britain, is that it has evolved into a branch of the welfare state. Mm. It's essentially social workers with dog collars. And it doesn't have the theological evangelizing mission element to it so much as it used to have. And that's what saved it in the 19th century. You know, in 1800, Britain was going through one of these fallow periods in which church attendance was very, very low. It increased across the 1800s because of evangelization, and that's what will do it.
So in the world that we live in, of course, evangelization, which means by its very nature proclaiming the good news, it's got to be answers to the questions that people are asking, I guess. So what is it? How can the church reclaim, and Catholics and other Christians reclaim an effectiveness in their witness? I mean, where are the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, those who reject religion as an identifier? What are the questions that they're asking that only the church can answer?
One question everyone says to me all the time is, why do I suffer? And I think sometimes people ask me that question to try and throw me off their own faith. And it can sometimes feel as though one's actually being challenged for the sake of trying to undermine your own faith when that question's asked. But actually, I've come to realize that very often people are asking themselves the question at the same time as they ask it to you. There is a lot of suffering in the world. It's a different kind of suffering from what we had 50 or 60 years ago. People live longer now. They're much richer. You know, times are tough, but people are much richer than they used to be. So suffering has changed. Now it's about living much longer. Now increasingly it's about existential angst. And our culture is full of people who are full of woe and talking about it. In America, you have Black Lives Matter. You have students protesting. You have transgenderism. You have all sorts of signs that people are basically unhappy. And I think the church needs to speak to that. Mm. And it needs to provide an answer, however, which is very straightforward and very simple, and which is rooted in the story of Jesus Christ, who died and was resurrected. And I'm always struck by how that's so rarely mentioned in Britain nowadays.
Mr. Stanley, can you hold on for just a couple of minutes on the other side of the break?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. We'll be back in just a minute with Timothy Stanley. Minutes before the hour, you are back on the Mike Allen Show on this Wednesday, May 25th. Thankful to have Timothy Stanley still on the line with us from Great Britain. Timothy Stanley, an English blogger, journalist, and historian. We were talking some about a story out of The Guardian, a survey really showing the rise of those who do not affiliate with any religion, the so-called nuns, not the N-U-N-S, but the N-O-N-E-S. And what's British Christian to do in the midst of what appears to be such a decline of faith? Thanks for holding on, Mr. Stanley.
It's a pleasure.
So you were talking about perhaps, as you had tweeted out, this is not a time for whining. This is a time to evangelize, which is what every baptized person's call and responsibility is to do. And one of the areas that you said perhaps would be a fertile ground for the church's witnesses related to the issue of suffering and finding meaning in suffering.
Yes, absolutely. But I think also visibility is important. As I say this, my point about evangelizing, you think of who does evangelize nowadays. It's the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Scientologists. Those are the only people who you see out on the streets evangelizing, at least in London. And you think back to how England was actually converted when it shifted from pagan to Christian, and it was done so by visibility. It was done by Christian preachers being seen and demonstrating what it meant to be Christian through simply being Christian, by good acts, by preaching, by praying. And it's the invisibility of Christianity, I think, is so remarkable in England. By contrast, I've just a couple of weeks ago came back from Morocco, North Africa, highly Islamic culture, not by any means as conservative society as one might expect. But what's really striking is how ever-present Islam is, and how visible it is, and how there's a real sense of a culture rooted in its past. And that's what's been lost in England, I think.
Do you think some of the lack of enthusiasm for evangelization speaks of a lack of interior confidence that even the believers seem to have, that their faith really has something to offer?
Yes, I think it could also speak quite simply to a lack of faith. It can be about that. When people are racked with doubts, they're less likely to promote something. They're less likely to proselytize because they're uncertain about it. That's understandable. And doubt and conscience have very strong roles to play in the Christian faith. It's one of the things that really marks us out as being different from many other faiths, is the respect that is placed upon skepticism and doubt. I do agree that. I think that a generation has emerged since the 1960s who are not educated strongly, whose form of religion was rooted in apology for mistakes made, apology for belief, apology for appearing to be too militant. And I think there's a reluctance to talk about it now simply because people are embarrassed and they don't have the language. They don't have the words. I'm very fortunate that my family was actually Baptist. And why I say that's fortunate is because I was raised in a household where the language of Christianity was very commonplace, and it doesn't feel strange to use it to make reference to dying and resurrection and being saved and washed in the blood of the Lamb. That doesn't seem strange to me. But of course, to the vast majority of people, it's language that seems alien and a little scary. So we've got to actually get back to using language, the language of evangelization. And it's stark sometimes shocking, sometimes frightening language that really grabs people's attention and wins them over.
Are you familiar with the Anglican Holy Trinity Brompton Church there in London and their Alpha ministry?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. It's very close to the London Catholic Oratory, actually, and you can sometimes hear it through the walls. And Trinity Brompton has provided the latest Archbishop of Canterbury, Anglican Archbishop, who is a very, very good Archbishop of Canterbury and a real breath of fresh air. And their strategies for evangelization is working. One group of people who you see a rise in church attendance in England is evangelicals and particularly Pentecostals, which again is to do with immigration. It's to do with people from West Africa and the Caribbean. But it's also simply because those people evangelize and it does work.
As a Brit who spends a good bit of time observing things over here in the States, I mean, do you think the U.S. is on a similar faith decline trajectory, maybe a little bit behind, but certainly on that same path?
America is definitely changing, and you see that in surveys. You do see the rise of people who have no faith. You also see the rise of a political center of gravity, which is within the Democrats. The Democrats are increasingly becoming a secular party. That is quite hostile to at least conservative and orthodox forms of faith. So I do see evidence for that. I have more hope in America because American history is a cycle of religious decline and then great awakening. And you've had four. You've had four great awakenings. I think you're due a fifth. And one of the reasons why you get them is because even if you do feel as though God plays a reduced role in the life of the average American, he is still steeped in religious language, imagery, and instinct that he can always tap back into it and bring it out again. So I think that American culture is still far richer when it comes to religion than much of Western Europe. And for that reason, I think it's got the resources to turn things around.
I know. I also wanted to ask you this question because I know you spend a lot of time thinking and writing about politics, both in your native England, but also the American political scene. We've talked a little bit about this before, but now that it's become apparent that it's just going to be a Trump versus Clinton race, it's put a lot of people, I think, a lot of Catholics that I know in a bit of a quandary because, you know, whereas in the past they felt pretty confident about who they were going to vote for. I think there's a lot of people who are thinking they struggle in good conscience to vote for either candidate.
Yeah, and I would be in exactly the same position, and I would understand that. On the one hand, Trump is so compromised as a personality, not just by his politics and what he said. I think it's possible. It's possible with some intellectual stretch work to decide that you can reconcile yourself to Trump's politics. It's very difficult to reconcile yourself to Trump's background and history and his ethics. But on the other hand, everyone who says they are instinctively, immediately anti-Trump, the never-Trump crowd, they have to explain what the alternative is. And of course, at the moment, the only alternative is Hillary Clinton. And the Clintons are just as ethically compromised. And their politics is in many ways even more unfriendly to the Catholic faith. So I sympathize a great deal. We still haven't seen the emergence of a serious third-party alternative. There is the Libertarian, there is Gary Johnson. There's some hope there. But I think it'll be interesting to see what happens if a serious mainstream Republican throws their hat into the ring as a third party, and I suspect a lot of people will look at them.
Well, I know that there's probably there's a little schadenfreude sometimes among the Brits when they look over here at the U.S. But is there a certain scratching of the head of how does this country of 300 million people, these are the candidates they've come up with?
Yeah, people are pretty astonished. But on the other hand, it confirms a lot of what we think of America anyway. And if you asked a British person to describe a Republican presidential candidate, if they'd never heard of Donald Trump, they would describe Donald Trump. In many ways, the choice is an absolute no-brainer, an incredibly rich, vulgar guy with a very simple form of Christianity, which borders on illiterate, who is actually ethically quite compromised and politically incredibly right-wing and xenophobic. That's most people's impression of what a Republican is. What is frustrating is that the British are in love with Hillary Clinton And that's partly because the rest of the world is stuck on this idea that America needs to elect a woman. Why doesn't Western Europe just get on and do it itself? Rather than saying America needs to do it, I do not know. But that's the problem, is we've got trapped in this narrative of it's time for an American, for America to have a woman. And I fear a lot of Americans are trapped in that narrative too.
As somebody who is a political analyst and writer, though, that this has to be a very interesting election, to say the least.
It is, in the sense there's a lot of content to pour through. But actually, intellectually, this is quite a barren election. I felt there was much more to say about Romney versus Obama, and there was a lot more to say about McCain versus Obama. By contrast, the problem with these two candidates is they intellectually have no depth to them at all. Hillary Clinton is simply about winning. When you write about Hillary Clinton, it's an analysis of strategy. And it's a strategy which is micromanaged and boring because she always plays it safe. By contrast, when you write about Trump, you're writing about the politics of outrageousness. And that's great, but there's only so many times you can write Donald Trump is shocking. People get that. They understand that. Actually identifying a genuine intellectual contest between these two is very difficult. And it's not yet emerged. They've not actually yet properly run a critique of each other's policy. And until we see that, it's actually very difficult to know what to say right now.
Yeah, you make a great point. And I think you mentioned you thought this was the election America needs to have.
Yeah, I think it is. Things had to hit this low. Things had to get this bad before people realize that they need to rethink the way their party works. And that is going to happen. You look at the Democrats. Bernie Sanders is going to take this fight all the way to the convention, where he's going to demand rules changes that make it so that you can't coronate a Clinton anymore. And likewise, moderate Republicans, non-Trump Republicans, they are going to start searching way in advance in future for a candidate who can stop this sort of thing from happening again. So I think this is an end of an era type election. I suspect this is not going to be the norm. In both cases, conservatives and liberals are going to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Well, Timothy Stanley, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you staying on through two segments with us, and appreciate your great work. And again, I want to encourage people to follow you on Twitter and to check out a lot of your writing. You have a great perspective, and you're a great witness for the faith as well. So thanks for all you
do. Thank you very much. God bless you.
God bless you too. We'll be back with a new hour on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. Again, we'll be talking to Eve Tushnet. What's a parent to do when their child tells them they're gay? They want to remain true to the faith as well. This is the Mike Allen Show.